Okay. So what is your name?
So I'm Catherine Lucas, and I also go by the name of Catherine G. Lucas in terms of my publications, although not when I was working for Bristol Crisis Service for Women. I hadn't that came later.
And how, when did you start working for Bristol Crisis Service for Women? And if, and how old were you? I was going to ask as well.
It was 2002, I think. I think it was 2002, and I was 39 at the time.
And how did you find out about the job and what attracted you to it?
I think it was an advert in the newspaper. And I can imagine, thinking back, the kinds of things that would have attracted me. I think on the one hand was, this was a charity, not-for-profit sector, which, certainly had an appeal, a strong appeal. I think the fact that it was, within the world of mental health, which was becoming more and more important to me at the time. My previous job had been for an advocacy, Patients Council advocacy project that was up north. And I think also the fact, probably, thinking back, I can imagine that Bristol Crisis Service for Women at the time, that they were looking for someone with personal experience of mental health kind of issues. And if they weren't specifically looking for that, then they were certainly totally open to candidates having that kind of background.
And so is that, you mentioned you were working for an advocacy service up north. Like, what were the sort of circumstances? Had you recently moved to Bristol, or what was the circumstances that you were looking for a job?
This is a fun part of the story, Ellen. I had been living on the Leeds-Liverpool Canal in a canal boat, and what happened was that as I was getting more and more interested in the mental health world, because I came from an academic background, I'd been teaching at university, teaching European studies. I mean, it was just a world away. But I was doing a psychotherapy training. I had a lot of my own healing work to do because I come from quite a dysfunctional, wounded family. My father was an alcoholic, so there was a lot of stuff of healing work that I needed to do. So I was doing a part-time psychotherapy training, and that involved going down to Devon once a month for a weekend, and it was a hell of a trek from Liverpool, from the northwest. It was a long way. So I decided that I needed to kind of at least move down to kind of like the Midlands or, And so basically, I kind of set off in my canal boat and kind of moved my home, lock, stock, and barrel, with some help, I have to say, because I couldn't have done that journey. You've got locks and things to contend with. I couldn't have done that journey on my own. And I basically got as far as I could with the boat, which I think was Stourbridge. And I think that's about as far as I could get in terms of the canal system. So then I was kind of job hunting. I kind of basically I relocated so that the psychotherapy training just became would be more feasible for me and manageable. And that meant moving home and finding a new job.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. Were you looking to get involved in a woman-only organisation? You said about the mental health side, but was that one of the things that attracted you?
No, not particularly. That wasn't that. That wasn't kind of part of my agenda, really. I think it was more the focus on the kind of mental health side of things, really.
And can you tell me about your role at BCSW?
So I did a little bit of digging to kind of I went back because this is kind of like nearly 20 years ago. I couldn't even remember my job title, so I managed to find that on an old CV. And so my official title was Information Service Coordinator. Now, that probably doesn't necessarily tell you very much. So let me explain what was involved. So I was responsible for developing, producing, and disseminating information on self-injury. Now, obviously, Bristol Crisis Service for Women was already doing that, you know, already had some fantastic resources, some fantastic material that was already, you know, had already been produced and was already being kind of put out there, if you like. But this funding, this was a Department of Health funding. It was a 3-year post, funding for 3 years. And there were two or three different parts, different kind of sections to the role, if you like. And so it was specifically to develop new material around two or three kind of, if you like, groups of people in need. And one of those was young people. And I don't think it was from memory. It wasn't exclusively young women. It was just young people, teenagers. And in a sense, you know, I think I'm trying to remember now the definition of that. I think it was either under 18 year olds or under 16 year olds. But in actual fact, a lot of the kids that I worked with on that project were, you know, really quite young. You know, not even teenagers. Some of them. So that was one piece of it. And then, I mean, I'll tell you more about kind of how I left and why I left. You know, I ended up leaving the project. I had to leave. Well, I guess I didn't have to leave. I chose to leave early. And so the subsequent parts of the project, I believe, were picked up by my successor. So I think the next piece of the project was working with women in prison. So developing materials around self-injury for women in prison. And of, you know, for me, what was very important about that work was really involving and including right from the beginning the end use, you know, people who were going to be helped and who were going to benefit from this material. You know, they, as far as I was concerned, and I think this is kind of good practice generally from what I gather, is that, you know, they are the experts. And, you know, I wasn't, by that time I was 39 years old, I certainly wasn't a young person. So really, you know, I was with Bristol Crisis Service for Women. I think it was about 18 months to 2 years before I left. And I completed what I completed that piece of work around producing material for young children. And, you know, from what I can gather over the years, it seems that the Rainbow Journal was reprinted again and again, which was just really heartwarming for me to know that it was, you know, even all those years later. I don't know if it's, I get the impression it's not available right now, but it's certainly, you know, obviously carried on helping so many youngsters. And you know, and I was thinking that the kids that were involved in the project, who contributed such fabulous artwork and poetry and quotes, you know, they'll now be like, you know, if they were 12 at the time, they'll kind of like be 32 now. And, you know, and I hope that they have a sense of just what a fabulous thing they contributed to and how much it's helped others. I kind of went off on a bit of a tangent, but and there's I'm sure there's more to say about that as well.
Well, I was going to ask, have you worked with children and young people before, or was that a new thing for you?
No, I hadn't. And in fact, I have to say, I didn't really work directly with them, in a sense, in that, you know, I didn't feel that I had the skills or the experience or expertise to do that. There was some extraordinary synchronicity that happened around, you know, how I managed to have access to these young people, because obviously, you know, it's kind of, well, where do you find youngsters who are known to be self-injuring, you know, and who are kind of supported, you know, they're kind of, because obviously it's really important that they're totally supported. If they're providing, if they're getting involved with the project, then it needs to be done really sensitively and carefully. And what happened was that I went to a conference in London. I can't remember what the conference was about, but I met a guy there at the conference. And it just like completely out of the blue. I mean, I really felt that the universe was kind of guiding this, really. It turned out that he was a member of staff at this school, it was a cross between a home and a school, kind of residential facility in Norfolk. And he was just instantly just so receptive to the idea. He was just really up for it, offered to help and to get the kids involved. And it was just great. I did actually go over to Norfolk. I did go there once and visit. And yeah, it was just a real privilege and an honor. Yeah, so it was very much thanks to him that we were able to develop such fantastic material, him and the kids.
So did they provide, what was their input? How did it work?
So I think what happened was, I'm trying to remember now. It's sort of coming back to me. I think he worked with another member of staff who I think was maybe an English teacher. And so what we devised was we came up with a few phrases that the children could complete. So, for example, I don't know, when I'm feeling, whatever, or I self-injure because, and so I think we helped them a little bit with starting some phrases, so to kind of help create a few little quotes and for them to kind of express their inner world a little bit, really, of kind of what was happening for them emotionally when they felt the need to harm themselves. And so that was kind of like on the written side, and then they also contributed some artwork and some poetry. So the Rainbow Journal itself, and I'm hoping that there'll be that there will be a copy in the archives so that people can kind of look at it as they're listening to this as well. As you turn the pages of the Rainbow Journal, it's kind of dotted through. There might be one page that's a beautiful picture or drawing or painting or something, and then maybe the next page is blank, because the idea was that it could be used as a kind of like a diary, a journal for youngsters to share, quite privately for themselves, record what was going on for them to help them process their feelings a little bit. And so I think at the bottom, where there was a blank page, there was maybe a little quote, one sentence along the bottom of the page, and then the first name and the age of the youngster that had contributed that. And then there might be another page where there was the whole page was given over to a poem. So it was kind of laid out with these pages kind of interspersed with plenty of blank pages with these kind of wiggly lines where they could write their own, just use it as a resource in that way as well. And then I also included something which was kind of like a scale, a kind of like 1 to 10, where so that they could with self-harm at one end and self-care at the other, because I think that the whole idea from what I can remember was really encouraging them to kind of start thinking about self-care and how to move from self-harm to self-care. So in any one day they could kind of have a look at that. It was a very simple thing. They just kind of marked, were they feeling like a 3 in terms of being closer to self-harm than the self-care end, or maybe they were having a good day and it was more like maybe an 8 or even a 9 or something at the self-care end. So there was that little bit of a scale as well for them to kind of check in with themselves, I guess, a little bit. And then at the end, we included, and this is the name, if you like, the Rainbow Journal, was we included the lyrics from Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which is kind of, you know, just really positive, uplifting, inspiring, just kind of really giving these youngsters hope, you know, that was the aim, really. And I'm talking a lot about the Rainbow Journal because that's basically, you know, that was what I did for 18 months, you know, in terms of kind of, you know, working on, I set up a steering group. So with two or three other people, I think there were four of us all together. So somebody from the Bristol kind of women's support group, self-injury group, and then a guy that I knew who was working in mental health, very much kind of like grassroots mental health, and had done, you know, some of that kind of developing material and stuff. So we had this little steering group, and I've kind of slightly lost my thread of what I was talking about before I mentioned the steering group, but I'm sure it'll come back.
No, it's fine. I was going to ask, where did you get the idea for the scaling thing? Was it something that you'd adapted from other resources, or was it something that came from the young people? Or
that's a great question, Ellen. And you know, I can't quite remember. I've got a feeling I borrowed it from somewhere. I wonder whether it was even in some of the other self-injury support material. You know, maybe it was in an existing resource of what was then Bristol Crisis Service for Women. Or I'm trying to think where else I might have borrowed it from. Nope, blank on that one.
No worries. And I was going to ask, once you had the resource kind of finalised and you'd had all the whole process of the young people inputting and that sort of thing, how did you then go about getting it out there to young people in Bristol?
Yeah. And of course, we weren't just getting it out to young people in Bristol, because already the remit of Bristol Crisis Service for Women was national. You know, people were contacting BCSW from all over the country. I think there's one more piece that I remember that I just wanted to share, was that, you know, once we'd got it all together and we were getting close to kind of publication date, because I just remembered there was another part of my role which wasn't the Rainbow Journal, which was looking after the kind of publications and resources and arranging for printing whenever any printing was needed, like maybe the annual report. I seem to remember I looked after kind of getting that printed. And so I also dealt, I had to kind of built up a good relationship with the printers that we were using at the time. And so I'd been talking through with them, you know, how we were going to physically do this, what it was going to look like. And we were kind of getting closer. I think we'd even set the launch date, because there was a whole run up to that in terms of organizing the launch. But we didn't have a front cover. And it was like, oh my goodness, you know, we've got this fabulous resource, but we've got no front cover. And this is what I mean by, you know, I think for me, the whole project felt so kind of guided and supported by the universe, because suddenly out of the blue, a young artist got in touch, kind of wanting to kind of help out and, you know, volunteer, saying, you know, what can I do? How can I help? You know, in terms, yeah, just generally. And of course I kind of leapt at the chance and said, wow, well, as you're an artist, it just so happens that we need a front cover. And bless her, I mean, she produced a beautiful front cover, and she did it in a relatively short space of time as well. And so that was kind of like the final piece that kind of fell into place. And actually, her name, I can't remember her name, but it will be in the inside cover of the Rainbow Journal. So how did we get it out to youngsters? Well, the first thing really that we did was around the launch. So we organized, I think there must have been within the budget for this, they kind of, we must have kind of, you know, there must have been some money basically to be able to have a launch event, because of course that's part of the dissemination. It was an important part, really. I think we invited the press as well. I can't remember what the, you know, I think the kind of the, like the local press. But what we certainly did was we reached out to all the kind of mental health organizations and charities and young people's organizations. You know, I kind of built up a whole list of kind of who to send invites out to. And you know, with a slight using the kind of free buffet lunch as a little bit of a, you know, kind of a carrot. Although, to be fair, I think a lot of people were genuinely really interested in the new resource as well. And so that was the beginning of the dissemination. And I don't remember what venue we used for that, but I can see in my mind's eye, I can see the rows of chairs. And we put a copy of the Rainbow Journal on each chair so that everybody would take a copy away. And then from there, what we specifically did, and I think again, you know, there must have been a budget for this, was that basically under 18-year-olds could have free copies. I think one, you know, they could have one free copy for themselves, whereas obviously social workers or mental health workers or whoever, you know, therapists, whoever wanting to use it as a resource, they needed to pay for it and buy it. And I'm guessing that over the years, I'm hoping that it created some, you know, some good revenue for Bristol Crisis Service for Women.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for taking me through all of that. It's really interesting. I was going to ask, in terms of, it's going back a little bit, sorry, but I was going to ask, did you do any training when you first came in around this kind of thing? You kind of mentioned a little bit about the approach to self-injury that the organisation had, or did you just kind of launch straight into it?
Do you mean, did I receive any training or did I offer any training?
I mean, so this question is, did you receive any? Right. I can ask the other one later.
I don't remember particularly receiving any training. I think what I did do was I seem to remember borrowing various resources because I wanted to read up and learn as much as I could about self-injury. And I seem to remember that's what I did. Yeah.
And then, yeah, did your role involve you offering any training?
I don't think so, not particularly.
That's cool. And then in terms of the staff team that you worked with, so who was like your manager or your supervisor?
So it was Hillary, and I'm ashamed to say I can't even remember her name, but to be fair, it was 20 years ago nearly. but Hillary, I mean, you know, she obviously she's very well known. She was kind of like the kind of, she led and did a fantastic job of leading Bristol Crisis Service for Women and including into that transition, I believe, of the change of name to self-injury support, you know, for many decades. So Hillary was my manager, my kind of supervisor, yeah. And then there were at least two other members of staff that I remember at the time. One kind of more kind of like on kind of like office type duties. And then I think the other woman was working more closely with the volunteers and kind of managing that side of the service, I think. And that was pretty much the team at the time.
And did you have any contact at all with the volunteers, or did you work very much with them?
I think the time when I had contact with the volunteers was when I attended there were meetings. I can't remember whether they were monthly or quarterly, but meetings kind of like with the trustees and the volunteers. And I think as a member of staff, I went to some of those meetings. And so I would meet the volunteers then. I think I probably also, you know, sometimes they might pop into the office to pick something up or to have a chat with Hillary or something. So I did get to know some of them. But I didn't, you know, my role didn't involve contact with the volunteers per se. And the volunteers at the time was mainly the helpline.
And can you remember any particularly like strong personalities within the staff team or volunteers or board?
Well, I think Hillary was a strong woman and a strong leader and did a fantastic job. I don't remember strong personality. I mean, I think in a sense we all, you know, we were kind of confident women who were kind of who had a sense of purpose. You know, I think there was a sense of shared kind of purpose and mission, even though I was only there for, you know, a relatively short period of time. I did feel very committed to the work and the aspiration behind the work.
I was going to ask, what was the kind of atmosphere like in terms of working there? Can you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, I think it was harmonious. I don't remember, because, you know, I have a very sensitive thermometer, if you like, to kind of conflict, and I certainly don't remember, you know, I don't remember that at all. I think it was maybe fairly, I don't know, I'm trying to think whether it was fairly serious or whether, you know, I think there were times when we had a laugh, but I think there were also times when, you know, we were just kind of getting our head down and getting on with the work. It was a relatively small open plan office. And so, you know, we were kind of in this space, and I think we had two or three telephones. So, you know, at any one time, I'm trying to remember, did we have two or three telephones? Maybe we didn't. Maybe we just had the one telephone line. I can't remember. But you know, I certainly, because as a highly sensitive person, an HSP, open plan offices are not a great working environment for me, because there's so much kind of stimulus and kind of, you know, and I was also at the time I was commuting, because I didn't live in Bristol. I lived near Stroud. I lived in a little village called Bewley. And so it was taking me about an hour to get to work every day, an hour to get to home. So I certainly remember that aspect of it. In terms of the downside, you know, I did work from home one day a week. I think I started doing that just to help with the commute. And of course, you know, what I soon discovered was that I got so much done when I worked from home that it was a real win-win.
In terms of the way the organization worked, obviously its roots are in a collective. Like, did it feel like a very flat structure, or did it still feel hierarchical?
No, I would say it didn't particularly feel hierarchical. I mean, you know, Hillary's management style was so kind of inclusive and empowering. You know, we were very much, I felt totally supported, but at the same time I was given, you know, free rein and kind of pretty much total independence. So from that point of view, you know, it didn't, I mean, obviously, you know, she was my manager, but it didn't feel kind of heavily or overly hierarchical. Having said that, you know, I guess it was no longer a collective in the sense that we had different roles, and we weren't just working as a team as equals.
And was feminism anything that was discussed, like in the office or in terms of the organization?
You know, I don't particularly remember that. But it may have been, I don't particularly remember that, Ellen. I can't really answer your question effectively, I don't think.
That's absolutely fine, thank you. In terms of you, you were saying that you were training outside. Were you involved in any like other mental health activism or work outside of this role?
I got slightly confused there. The training, the psychotherapy training I was doing. So the psychotherapy training, that was part of my healing journey. I wasn't doing the training to become a psychotherapist. I was doing the training. I did the 6-month foundation and then I did the first year, and that pretty much overlapped with my time at Bristol Crisis Service for Women. But I, as I say, I wasn't doing that to become a therapist. I was doing it because I knew I had a lot of stuff to look at and to process and to heal. I wasn't involved in other projects. I think I can imagine that I had my hands full at the time. But after I left Bristol Crisis Service for Women, I certainly did get involved in I ended up setting up a not-for-profit myself, the vision with that was to help contribute to a paradigm shift in mental health. And I think this is probably a good moment to bring in a little bit about my personal journey and why I ended up leaving Bristol Crisis Service for Women early, in a sense. Because as I say, you know, it was a kind of like a 3-year funding and a 3-year contract. But what happened was that while I was doing that very deep healing work on the psychotherapy training, it actually triggered a crisis for me. And I ended up going through the kind of profound, it was what's known in transpersonal psychology as a spiritual emergence and a spiritual emergency. So it's the kind of crisis where there's an awakening of consciousness happening, and there's also kind of like mental health issues kind of wrapped up in there. As I mentioned, you know, that I come from quite a dysfunctional family. So I ended up in crisis. I think it was partly because the depth of the holding within that psychotherapy training was such that I was able to go to some really deep, dark places. And so all this unconscious material from the psyche kind of came up to the surface to be dealt with. Like all, you know, the analogy that I use is of a volcano kind of exploding with all this kind of lava and molten kind of rock and ash kind of all exploding coming up to the surface at once. So it was very intense. And I actually ended up off work for a couple of months. So for a couple of months, I wasn't able to, you know, that was within my time at Bristol Crisis Service for Women. Where I went through this kind of, just a profound, profound crisis, which thankfully I had the right understanding. I had people around me who weren't going to pathologize it and tell me that there was, you know, that I had a mental health issue, that this was a kind of a healing crisis, a crisis of an awakening of consciousness through that process. And so it really marked a complete turning point in my life. It was kind of like a watershed. There's kind of like my life before that crisis and my life after that crisis. So it was almost like my life before and up to Bristol Crisis Service for Women and then my life after. And, you know, I completely recreated my life and myself. Based on that healing and like all the parts of me that just weren't serving me and were, that it was time to let go of. So I was supported. I mean, in a sense, you know, I think Bristol Crisis Service for Women supported me through that process. They certainly, you know, I was able to take the time off work that I needed. And then I went back just slowly, gradually, you know, the first few weeks, I just went back, you know, kind of gradually and gently. And then, you know, I was obviously, you know, this project, I was kind of partway through this Rainbow Journal project, which I was very keen to complete. But then, you know, not long after the launch, I actually handed in my notice because I basically needed to take time out to process the enormity of what I had been through. And so I left where I was living. I left Bristol Crisis Service for Women. I actually went off on retreat for 2 months. I went to a Buddhist retreat place in Devon called The Barn and just gave myself the time and space to kind of be with the enormity of what I've been through and who this new woman emerging was. And then from there, you know, interestingly, having published the Rainbow Journal, I did end up writing books, and I've had four books published subsequently. So it was kind of like the beginnings were there. Although I think the Rainbow Journal is the one that sold the most copies.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. Like it really helps us put it in context, but I appreciate it's quite personal. So thank you. I was going to ask about if you feel that time when you're working there had any particular impact on you at all, which you've kind of started to talk about, but is there anything you'd like to expand around that?
Yeah, I think, I think it was, it was a really important time in my life. I think in terms of, you know, just in terms of that project, in terms of, you know, how fulfilling and satisfying it was and how well it went and how it all fell into place. I think for me, it was probably the beginning of kind of just trusting that when we follow our intuition and our creativity and when we've got the right support, that, you know, that these kind of amazing things can emerge. It was almost like I was kind of like a channel for some of that to kind of come through. And so I think it was my first experience, probably. Yeah, I think it was my first experience of kind of tangibly just being able to start trusting, you know, just trusting. So like I mentioned, how just suddenly, completely out of the blue, at the 11th hour, an artist appeared to do the fabulous front cover. You know, that's the kind of that was, I think, part of the learning, which probably I didn't fully take on board at the time, but kind of, you know, thinking back, that I think that was the beginning, because that's very much how I operate now and how I, you know, and it's also because I teach groups now, and it's how I encourage group participants to kind of work as well, to kind of just step into that trust and following our guidance, our intuition, our hunches. And yeah, so that was an important piece. I think also, you know, it was very important for me in terms of kind of healing, the kind of like the mental health piece and being valued and recognized as having, you know, I had previously spent a month in a psychiatric hospital at the age of 20. So about 20 years before I joined Bristol Crisis Service for Women, I had spent a month in a psychiatric hospital when my parents split up, you know, after my mother had kind of lived with an alcoholic for 23 years of marriage. And I also want to, and I just want to, in parenthesis, I just want to say that, you know, I've totally healed my relationship with my father. You know, I kind of totally understand how and why he became an alcoholic. And so, but yeah, it was at the time when my parents divorced and I was at university, and I ended up in hospital for a month. So I think my time with Bristol Crisis Service for Women, of just, you know, not needing to hide or be ashamed of that past, you know, it was kind of almost like welcomed that I could relate to the people we were helping and being of service to. Because I'd come from that place of having my own mental health kind of struggles and issues, and that it was seen almost as a plus and a bonus. And I think that was a very important part of my journey of kind of really stepping into my power, you know, fully, and being able to own all the different parts of myself.
Sorry, it's just really interesting. So I was just kind of processing that a little bit. But around that, I was going to say, do you think that was unusual at the time for your experience with your own mental health to be so valued and encouraged as something important that you could bring to the role?
That's a really good question, Ellen. And I think 20 years ago, that was starting to come in. There was a recognition that if you were working in the mental health field, certainly in the charity sector, not-for-profit sector, if you were working with experiencers, then, you know, there was this growing appreciation of how valuable that could be to have personal experience. My sense is that that has continued to improve and to grow in the two decades since then. Because, you know, we now see that there are paid roles, you know. Well, I mean, I was in a paid role, but, you know, there are now all sorts of different paid roles that are specifically for people with personal experience of some kind of like mental health struggles. So I think there was some appreciation of it then, but maybe not so much in the mainstream in the NHS. I think that's come maybe more since then.
Also, in terms of how, I guess, society or people would see self-injury, do you feel like that has changed since you were working for BCSW?
I think in terms of whether it changed while I was there, I mean, it was almost like I was there too short a period of time, really. In terms of how it's changed in the last 20 years, that's difficult for me to say because I kind of moved on into a different field of mental health, into more like the relationship between the spiritual, the transpersonal, and mental health. And so I was kind of, you know, I've been very focused, totally focused on that, really. And so, you know, I've kind of lost touch with the self-injury world. So I can't really comment on whether public perception has changed. I would like to think it has. And certainly, you know, Bristol Crisis Service for Women's Self-Injury Support has certainly contributed to, you know, if it has, then I'm sure that self-injury support has been a major kind of factor and contributor to that.
Would you say, is there any other ways in which society views mental health, like, generally, that you feel has changed, like anything significant in terms of your work?
Not enough and not quickly enough, really, I feel, you know, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I know there are some positive developments in terms of things like open dialogue coming in, where people are being encouraged to just kind of share their stories and you know, what happened to them, rather than just being automatically prescribed drugs. But there's still a huge amount of work that is needed. And certainly in terms of my work on the transpersonal spiritual side, there's still a long, long way to go in terms of that being recognized as a crucial piece, really. It's still pathologized. You know, if somebody experiences Christ consciousness and tells a psychiatrist that they feel like they're Jesus or that they are Jesus, that is still pathologized, rather than an understanding that actually there's an important spiritual process happening there where somebody is connecting with the energy of Christ consciousness. So we really need to be supporting people very differently when they're going through these kind of that particular kind of mental health crisis. And there's a lot, you know, my first book is focused very much on spiritual emergency, but my subsequent books have been more looking at, okay, so how can we look at mainstream psychiatry? You know, some of these labels like bipolar and schizophrenia. You know, what's actually happening? If we look at this from a more transpersonal point of view, and I do want to say that transpersonal psychology, for anybody listening who's interested, it's a huge field of work and research. You know, it's an academic field in its own right. And so, you know, we can have a look. And I did this in, I think it was in my second book, Coping with a Mental Health Crisis, where I look at, you know, when somebody's experiencing bipolar, if we look at that through a different lens, if we look at that from a more transpersonal spiritual lens, what is actually happening? And actually, it's an energy, you know, energetically, there's a lot of very powerful energy that needs grounding, which is why people can get manic. And our NHS still doesn't understand enough about grounding and grounding energy, really. So, I mean, I could talk for hours on this. This is the work that I've been doing for like 15, 20 years. I'm recently kind of slightly started moving in a new direction in a kind of more kind of global perspective, rather than kind of more macro perspective than the micro. But yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount that could be said about that. And I think, you know, there's something about hope. You know, my work has been very much about getting people to shift their mindset, to think differently. And if they're told that they have a mental health so-called disorder or label, and they're put in a box, and they're told that, you know, they're going to have that for the rest of their lives, they're going to need medication for the rest of their lives, it's very difficult, you know, when somebody in authority, who somebody is supposedly an expert, tells you that, it's very difficult to actually know different and to be able to kind of change your mindset and change the paradigm from which you're seeing things. And so my work has been very much about trying to help raise awareness and understanding that there's a different way of looking at mental health, that it's about, you know, what is it that needs healing? What is it that's asking for our attention? And so, yeah, so it's, and I think the Rainbow Journal, you know, was about that as well. It was giving these youngsters hope, you know, and kind of really valuing the person, the individual experience, the individual feelings and emotions. And that's kind of like the starting point.
What would you say was the best thing about your time working for BCSW?
The best thing about working there. Well, I think there were lots of really good things. I mean, one thing that's really lovely is that I'm still friends with and in contact with, despite having moved to Spain and despite the kind of COVID, I'm still in touch with another woman who was working there at the time. And so that's been a lovely friendship. I do feel very honoured and privileged to have been involved with the Rainbow Journal project, and I guess I also, you know, if I'm being honest, I do feel proud of you know, that piece of work that I did, you know, that it has hopefully helped so many youngsters, and I guess, you know, it was, as I say, it was a really, really important time in my life. It was such a turning point. That crisis that I went through and that I was then able to process. And I think at the time, you know, it must have been pretty devastating, really, for Bristol Crisis Service for Women and for Hillary, that, you know, there I was in post with a 3-year post and 3-year funding. And then halfway through, it's like, I'm sorry, I need to leave, because my life had just kind of, you know, was just going in such a different direction. So, yeah.
And I was going to say, what was the most challenging, if you haven't talked about it already?
Well, I think it was that. And, you know, it was difficult to leave, you know, to know that I had this contract, that in a sense, I mean, within the contract, I was, you know, completely entitled to give a month's notice. I think I actually, if I remember rightly, I think I probably gave longer you know, because it wasn't easy to kind of say, look, I'm really sorry, but I need to leave. I'm leaving. And yeah, you know, that was hard, I think. And I think also, you know, that period of crisis was, it was a very challenging time for me. You know, I mean, it was profound. It was, one of the reasons why I was off work for 2 months was just because it was terrifying what I went through. And so it took a long time for the, you know, just for the fear and the anxiety to kind of settle back down. So yeah, those were probably the main challenges.
And finally, my last question is, how did you feel when Bristol Crisis Service for Women changed their name to Self-Injury Support in 2014, if anything?
Yeah, well, I think it's great. I'm not sure that I was aware of it at the time because I was probably just, you know, not that kind of in touch with BCSW. But, you know, we had started talking about that and exploring it and discussing it back in like 2002, 2003. So already back then, you know, BCSW already had a national remit and national reputation, was really working at that level. So, you know, I think it's great. I think, you know, but having said that, I wasn't involved in the early days where, you know, of the roots of the kind of the collective that BCSW kind of grew out of. So I guess I didn't have that attachment to the history and the roots of those very early days, which I'm sure, you know, I know from having set up a not-for-profit myself, the you know, those early days, they're special, precious memories, you know, when we come together as a team and just kind of dream up this vision of what we want to create and put out into the world. And actually, Ellen, just going back slightly to one of your earlier questions, I think that's probably one of the things also that came out of my time there was just, it kind of gave me the idea of how, you know, we can create organizations that can have a positive influence and can create change. So, you know, and in fact, the not-for-profit that I set up, we called it the Spiritual Crisis Network. So it had the word crisis in the title. So I think, you know, I think it's fair to say that there was, you know, BCSW kind of had some kind of role and influence in shaping that in me as well. But going back to the change of name, yeah, I mean, I think it's great. And as I say, I don't have those early historical kind of roots and attachments. But yeah, we were talking, it had been discussed for a very long time before it actually happened.
Awesome. And is there anything else that you feel we've missed and you'd like to talk about your time there?
Let me just have a quick, I'm just having a look because I did make jot some notes down earlier. So let me just have a quick look. I'm just looking at my notes. No, I think we've covered everything. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. It's been fun. And I hope that it's, yeah, I hope it's really beneficial and useful for researchers and for the history of the organization. And yeah.